Hello, SEC, and all of our listeners out there. This is Pastor Ben, lead pastor of Shuswap Community Church in beautiful British Columbia. And this is our second episode, our first official episode of the Deep Dive Podcast, Romans Edition. If you heard the teaser trailer, we introduced you to Steve Jan, director of Miller College of the Bible in Sunnybrae on Shuswap Lake in BC. Steve teaches Romans, directs the college, and is a renowned local coffee roaster as well. So we're happy to have him here today. We're going to get into Romans chapter 1. Now, if you haven't read the book, why don't you just hit pause and just read it. Spend some time just kind of soaking it up. Paul goes right into the meat of the whole thing, and we want to make sure that we're not getting ahead of you. What we're going to do is dialogue through the chapter. Steve's going to answer some questions. What does it say? What does it mean? We'll talk about the resistance that's within our hearts to God's word, and we're going to talk about why it matters. So as we do that, maybe just take a minute, and if you haven't already read it, just hit pause on this as well. Steve, as we step into the book of Romans, every book is written to a particular church that has a particular cultural makeup. Can you give us a little bit of insight into the background of Paul's writing to the church in Rome?
Yeah, no, that's great. That's a great starting point. I mean, if you read the first, 15 verses of chapter 1, it becomes exceedingly clear that Paul has some deep affection for the believers in Rome, this church in Rome. What's interesting is that the Apostle Paul did not start this church. He didn't do any church planting in Rome. Though Rome was on his radar, he wanted to go to Rome. That's so clear in this text as well. There's no official biblical record in terms of how the church started, but probably if you read Acts chapter 2, there were Jews that had gathered on the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem, and it clearly says in Acts chapter 2 that there were those from Rome, Jews from Rome. Likely people there had come to faith in Jesus after Peter's message. Go back to Rome and start sharing this new found faith that they have in their Messiah, in Jesus. And then, of course, in chapter 11, after the persecution of Stephen under Saul's, or the Apostle Paul previous to being Paul, he was Saul under his sort of supervision, they kill Stephen, they stone him to death, and then there's this persecution. And so the church gets spread all over the place in that region. And so the church begins somehow by God's Spirit. That's what he does, isn't it? I mean, that's what the Spirit of God does. He does his work. And this church is formed. So Paul hears about the church. Now, what's interesting about the church is that when it first started, it would have been primarily Jewish. It would have had a very Jewish cultural feel to it. What's important is not the dates, but I'm going to throw a couple of dates out to you. What's important for us to understand as we approach this book is the background to why Paul wrote this letter. In 49 AD, there was a Roman emperor named Claudius, and he, because of various reasons, but one of them was this idea that there were these Jews who were following this guy named Christus, or Jesus, hands down an edict and kicks all of the Jews out of Rome, which would have included the believing Jews. And so they're exiled out of Rome. And from 49 until 54 AD, so for 5 years, Rome is kind of Jew-free. But by God's grace, the church continues to grow. At least that would be the indication. And so after Claudius's death, the Jews start to slowly filter back into Rome. They're trickling back in, and they come and see what's going on in these home churches. That's probably what they were, these gatherings. And they recognize that what they left, it looks so different now. It's got a very strong Gentile flavor to it. And I mean, there are some clear Gentile Jew issues back in the first century that the church had to figure out and work out. Jews were still carrying a lot of those laws from the Torah, a lot of those, not the moral law so much, but more the practice.
Yes. Cultural distinctives.
Yeah, exactly. Those cultural distinctives. And so now they come back. Just imagine, they have a potluck after one of their gatherings, and the Gentiles are pulling out their bacon and tomato and lettuce sandwiches, and the Jews are horrified. It's like, you can't be eating bacon, right? So, I mean, that's a bit of a stretch, but, and Paul recognizes that there are some issues. There's some tensions, and he knows the answer to how this is going to be dealt with best, and what the foundation of a church needs to be. And it's the gospel. And so this whole book is gospel centered, and there's some amazing thoughts, even in that first section, that point to that.
That's a really interesting thought, that Claudius would have sent all of the Jews away, whether they were Christians or not, that there were Jews who were being labeled as followers of Christ, even though they weren't. So there's Christians, then the church is facing likely backlash from the Jews of the day, let alone the cultural backlash from Rome that is obvious in that scattering. Paul was obviously a progeny when it comes to theology. He was a genius. You see and hear his scholarship, his upbringing. The whole book is just rich in deep theology. But what stands out to me, especially at a time of our church being scattered, it's May 2020, we're in the midst of the pandemic, is that as much as he's a theologian, as much as he's a scholar, he's ultimately a pastor. And this is a group of people that he has never met before, and yet he says in verse 11, I long to see you, that I may impart some sort of spiritual gift to strengthen you. His heart's towards the people. Yeah. And then to say this in verse 12, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. And you see his heart there, his heart for the church, but also his humility. That just kind of rings as a wonderful place to start, because a mere couple of verses later, it's going to get real. I mean, he's going to get tough, right?
Yeah, totally. I think that's a great observation. It really was this church and these people, and I think he probably felt about that way about all of the letters that we read in the New Testament. He's got that affection, but for sure for this church in Rome. And if you just go down a couple more verses to 15, he says, I'm eager. I can hardly wait to come and preach the gospel to you, which already is a little indicator that there's something going on in terms of the gospel having its effect on believers. And, you know, here's the amazing thing about, you know, this letter and me, you know, I mentioned in our teaser podcast that I get to teach our second years this, and this letter I have until this year. This past year, I actually gave that up, and one of our other profs is teaching now. So it hurts me a little bit, but they're in great hands. And, but you know, it had probably been about 4 years until I noticed something just spectacular. And maybe I can just point it out, because I think one of the challenges for us as followers of Jesus is that we can have a one-dimensional gospel view, where we kind of think as the gospel is for those who don't know Jesus. And it's true.
That's so important. When I look back over my life, the only time growing up, and granted, I was a stupid kid with some immature thoughts, but I was a youth group kid growing up in the 90s, culturally, formed by this subculture that we called Christianity, pop Christianity culture. And the only time I remember hearing about the gospel was when we had to go out and do evangelism.
Totally.
But what you're saying is that the gospel is as relevant for the believer as it is for the unbeliever.
Totally. Yeah, and I think that for Paul to say, I'm eager to come preach to you, that's one thing. But if I can just point you to this spectacular verse, and it just, one day the template kind of fell in my mind, and it was the Spirit of God who showed me this. But, you know, the first few verses, he's talking about the gospel. He says, I've been set apart for the gospel. Verse 2, this gospel has been promised beforehand through the prophets. So this gospel is something that was ordained in God's heart even before before he created the world. And the topic is Jesus. He's king, he's a descendant of David, and specifically the resurrection from the dead. But then look at verse 5, through whom we have received grace and apostleship. And this is why. This is why Paul is writing about the gospel, to bring about the obedience of faith for the sake of his name among all nations. So that's a really critical phrase. He says, I want to write this letter with a gospel center in order to, and that's what I've been called to, this apostleship, in order to bring about the obedience of faith for the sake of his name among all nations. Now, just keep that in mind. Go to the very last chapter, Ben. I want you to look at chapter 16, and you're going to find in his closing remarks almost the identical words. And when you see these kind of bookends, you understand that there is something really, really important to recognize. So in verse 25, he says, "Now to him who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel." So there's that gospel theme again, and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but has now been, that's the whole prophecy, right? Prophets foretold from way back when, but now has been disclosed, and through the prophetic writings has been made known to all nations. There's the all nations language, according to the command of the eternal God. Watch now. For what purpose? To bring about the obedience of faith. The identical phrase that he uses in chapter 1 to start, he ends with that. So that should make us sit up and take note that his writing of this letter is going to be gospel-centered, gospel-infused with this one main idea. It's to bring about the obedience of faith. So followers of Jesus.
So let me ask you this then. So this idea, obedience of faith. So again, you know, I'm common from growing up in the church, trying to wrestle with what it means to be a Christian in the world. And my first trigger when I hear that obedience of faith is that there's something I have to do in order to accomplish my faith. Is that what he means here?
No, I think it's exactly the opposite. I think the idea that Paul is going to, and we're going to see it through this, especially when we get to chapter 6, 7, and 8. I mean, that's going to be kind of the climax. And you said last time that chapter 8 is kind of your favorite chapter in the Bible. The idea of our obedience is that it is gospel fueled. And the thing that's going to bring about our obedience is not just harder doing or more discipline or a Tony Robbins kind of mindset. Sorry to Tony Robbins, I'm sure he's a fine guy, but you know, this suck it up Marine kind of mentality. It's actually this understanding that God, Jesus is alive in us by spirit, and he's the one that's going to be doing the work through the work of the gospel in our life. So it's exactly the opposite of trying harder and doing more. It's resting in the finished work of the gospel.
Isn't that such a such an interesting thing that many of us are shaped by the world and by our world and by our lives. And we often kind of read scripture through the lens of our own background, through the lens of our own understanding, and assume some things, because I had never seen that before until you pointed it out, the obedience of the faith, that you and I can only be obedient by the work of the Holy Spirit, which has been imparted to us on the basis of our faith, not exactly of our works, through Christ. And it's Christ who is his living out the obedience in us. There's a lot of freedom in all of that, but also a lot of mystery. That's a very powerful statement. And so let me then just kind of push us to verse 16 and 17. Verse 16 and 17, where he says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." This sounds like his thesis statement for the whole book. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally.
Because it's so rich. So walk us through these two verses, if you will. Walk us through the gospel is the power of God for salvation to the Jew and to the Greek. And especially these words, that it's revealed from faith for faith.
Yeah. Or from the beginning and to the very end, this idea that it's going to be an ongoing, and we're going to see that our salvation, oftentimes we use English language like salvation as a one-time event. The reality is Steve Jansen needs to be saved today. I don't need to be justified today. That happened at one point. That's an awesome story of my life that God did in my life, but I need to be saved today. And so there's this idea that through the gospel, the righteousness of God is going to be revealed from the beginning of the faith to our faith to the very end of our faith. And the righteous shall live by faith. We're going to see a connection, verse 17, Ben, where it says, "For in it," talking about the gospel, if you read in the flow of the verse, "in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed." And in chapter 3, it's going to, once again, he uses the same language of the righteousness of God being manifest through the cross and through what Jesus did. And so you want to know what God looks like? You want to know what his righteousness looks like? Look to the cross. Look to the gospel. It's going to be a revealer of who God is. His love, his justice, his righteousness, his holiness, everything is kind of combined in the gospel message of the cross. And of course, he's not ashamed of it because his life had been transformed. I mean, on the Damascus Road, his life had been turned upside down 180 degrees. He knew the power of the gospel.
You said something really interesting just a minute ago, that you're being saved each and every day, that salvation is as relevant today as the first day that you realize you needed it. That justification happened one time, but the salvation happened. So I mean, it's like, what do you need to be saved from each and every day?
Yeah, that's how you can't get more practical, right? I mean, I need to be saved from the power of sin. Or maybe I'll even synthesize it one step further. I need to be saved from unbelief. God has said certain things about himself and about who I am in Christ and all that Christ has done, that every day the enemy, my flesh, and the world are going to be battering at. And I'm going to be so tossed back and forth with thinking other things about God, other things about who he says I am, that I actually need to be saved from those lies that are coming, being bombarded. So every day I need to be saved from the power of sin that's at work in my life until the day of Christ Jesus. Paul says in Philippians chapter 1, he'll bring it to completion in the day of Christ Jesus. Until that day, I need daily salvation from the power of sin that's, and I don't think any Christian would argue with that. Like we struggle with sin. I need to be saved from that. I need to be saved from the power, the influence, the unbelief that comes into my mind. I need to be saved from that.
That's good. And so he's saying that the gospel is what saves us from the power of sin. It saved us from the penalty of sin upon our justification. Yep. Will one day save us from the presence of sin, yep, in our glorification, or, you know, when we get to heaven or meet Jesus face to face. But even now, there's a power at work in our lives against sin and against the doubts and the lies of Satan, that the gospel answers. Why do you think he calls out the Jews and the Greeks specifically?
Well, because once again, he's writing to a church filled with Jews and Gentiles. And I think he's just trying to lay a level playing field. He's reminding them, yes, it did come to the Jews first. We know that. Jesus was a Jew. He comes. And it says in John chapter 1, he came to his own, but his own did not receive him. But there was this sense that, and we're going to see later in the book of Romans, that there is something to being a Jew. The oracles of God came. Jesus came through a Jewish lineage. And so that's why he says to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. So in other words, salvation is, it's flat ground. There is no hierarchy at the foot of the cross. There aren't, the Jews aren't at the front of the cross or at a higher, clot of dirt in front of the cross. We're all on even ground. And he's reminding, and this is maybe a little bit more for the Jews as he's writing. I don't know his intent here, but it could be. It's like, let's hang on a second. He's talking to, because the Jews were very religious. We're going to see that in chapter 2. He calls the Jews out. Chapter 1 is a little bit more broad, a little bit more general for the Gentiles. But man, he's going to come after the Jews in chapter 2 and remind them of who they are.
It's interesting. You know, some commentators have noted that the Jews and the Greeks had different views of what they needed to be saved from and the role that Christ would play in that. We know the Jews at Jesus' day, many of them rejected him and chose instead a religious expression as their basis of their hope for salvation. So it could be that he's saying, listen, this is the power of God unto salvation through Christ that confronts your religious tendencies. Yeah. And then maybe on the flip side of that, to the Greek saying, you've reduced Christ, you've removed his atonement, his atoning work on the cross and subsequent resurrection, and just treating him like an example. If I was to kind of generalize those two groups, the religious and the irreligious, that the religious treat salvation in Christ with a plus sign, and the Greeks, the irreligious, would add a minus sign to Jesus, diminishing his full work of the gospel on that. The idea that the gospel is what is in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. Boy, that's a hard phrase to wrap my head around, from faith for faith, and the attachment to righteousness that is in there.
Yeah, and I mean, I've wrestled with that phrase as well, and you're going to pick up different commentators and you're going to read different things and what was Paul's intent, but I really do think it's this idea that it's like the righteousness of God is an ongoing revelation in our life, and it makes sense, right? I mean, if the gospel's there to rescue me today, the moment let's just put this into a time frame. I came to faith when I was almost 19 years old in my second semester of Bible college. I'm going to Bible school for all the wrong reasons, and God graciously rescues me and saves me. So it's been a few years since I came to faith. So, you know, received the faith, received Jesus. But if I get rescued from my sinful tendencies today, or some sort of lie that I'm believing or unbelief today, and the gospel shines in on that, guess what I'm seeing? The righteousness of God again today. And that's going to be ongoing. And then one day in our glorification, we're going to see it fully. Until then, it's from faith to faith, or from faith for faith. And there is this sense that the only way we see the righteousness of Christ or God through the gospel is through faith. We have to trust what God says in his word.
Hmm. And then he kind of wraps up verse 17 with the righteous shall live by faith. So what he's doing to the Jewish mind is a total paradigm shift, that righteous will not live by religion, but will rather live by developing a deep trust in the saving work of Jesus that exposes us to his presence, to his promises, to his power that we might become his people. The righteous shall live by faith. And he's going to spend time talking about this, right?
Yeah, totally.
And using Abraham as an example of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the reality is the minute Christ's righteousness shines on my righteousness, I recognize that my righteousness isn't that great. It's actually like a filthy rag, right? Isaiah says. So, and so that's why it's so critical that we see the righteousness of Christ in the gospel and the cross, so that we recognize I got nothing. I'm bringing nothing to the table.
That's so good. Before we leave this section, I just want to just go back to Paul's first words. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Because I know that over the course of my life, there is this sense of I wouldn't call it embarrassment, but hesitation with the gospel, with a unwillingness to totally embrace it or to totally speak it clearly. And he speaks these so boldly, it's aspirational in a way. I aspire to be like that. But I find myself so oftentimes ashamed of the gospel. Where does that come from? Why is that there? Why is that a struggle?
Well, I think it's a natural struggle. Let's be honest here. I think because we are in our human flesh and we're struggling against the lies that I just talked about, some of these sinful tendencies, we struggle with the fear of man. At the very heart of it, we want people to kind of like us. And listen, the gospel, even presented in a gracious and kind way, still confronts a person with the reality of their own sin, and who likes to be told that they're sinners. And so I think that there is this deep-seated part of our nature, our human nature, our sinful nature, that just is afraid. And I think the answer to why could Paul be this way? And I think, I mean, the whole book of Romans, letter to the Romans, is about the gospel. I was listening to Vanderstelt the other day, and he was saying, we talk about what we love. We talk about what we love, and we love what we talk about, right? And so, I mean, you could ask me about my 1973 Datsun 510. I'll talk to you about that all day long. Why? And I'll talk to an atheist about that. I don't care what he thinks of me. But somehow there is this trigger in me that is a little bit afraid of how somebody might respond to the gospel. And I think our prayer, I think for myself and for our listeners, would simply be, Lord, would you help me to love the gospel to the degree that I can't help but talking about it? Be like Paul. I'm not ashamed of this. This is the best news ever.
Yeah, that's so good. I mean, it's something that I think every Christian needs to kind of confront when it comes to being intimidated by the gospel being shared with other believers. I also think, though, there's something deeper maybe even going on as well, you know, that oftentimes my shame is what I bring even in my relationship to God. Like when I think of the indelible nature of what my sin cost Christ, I feel ashamed. And then I look and I say, his defeating of my sin required his suffering and required his service. It wasn't this kind of superhero epic demonstration of his glory and of his power that I can just kind of come right in behind and follow in the wake of. It brings me to this place of humility. It brings me to this place of abject brokenness, if you will. And so I know that there's this tendency even in my own heart, because of my shame that I'm bringing to God, to just kind of say, I can pick myself up. I can show him that I'm worthy of this gift. I can live up to the expectation that he has. And in so doing, I've experienced that removes the power of the gospel in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, once again, that's a lie that we would believe, right? Those are all those things that the gospel wants to rescue us from. But ironically enough, it's those very things that'll keep us from being gospel centered oftentimes, right? It's crazy. That's a good word.
Yeah, it's just, you know, if the gospel is powerful, we should expect to see its power in our lives. Amen. Which is why I so appreciate your friendship and your willingness to always be bringing me back to the gospel. And you speak often about how each day you get up and preach the gospel to yourself. Tell our listeners about, you know, what that looks like practically.
No, I think that's once again, a great question. The Puritans used to call, sometimes we call spiritual disciplines, they used to call them the means of grace, or what are the ways in which I can find God's grace being poured out of my life? And so Bible reading is one of those things, and praying and fasting and sometimes pulling away and being in solitude. And but I think one of the means of grace in my life that God has been kind to show me is that I need to remind myself every day of who God is, who I am without him, who I was without him, what he did for me through Jesus on the cross, and how he's rescued me, and how he now lives in me by spirit, and one day is going to give me an eternal inheritance with Jesus. That's unbelievable. So I need to remind myself of that, because what that does is it arms me to face the day. And so what I would just call that like a regular rhythm of gospel care. So it becomes like Bible reading. I've written it out for myself, and it's not just a mantra. I read it through. I meditate on it, and it's all over the Bible. It's going to pop up everywhere you read. But beyond that, Ben, I think that there's a need to have these spontaneous rhythms of gospel interjection in our life as well. So it's 2:30 in the afternoon. I'm driving from Sunny Bray into Salmon Arm, and some guy cuts me off on the highway. And my natural tendency is to blow up, get angry, do something that maybe I shouldn't do, that's certainly in the flesh and not in the spirit. What do I need in that moment? I need a spontaneous rehearsing of the gospel to rescue me so that I might actually be saved from the temptation to sin at that moment. And so the regular rhythm of just meditating on, and we do it, I mean, in the church, every time we take communion, what are we doing? We're preaching the gospel to ourselves. And so Jesus even recognized there have to be some rhythms in your life for this, but then I need to also grow enough to the point where this is just spontaneous in my life and my reactions to the things that are coming down the pipe.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I think the Puritans got it right when they called disciplines means of grace, because what you described was in a lot of ways religious activities. It gets us, you know, gets my back up a little bit, whereas, you know, the purpose of Bible study, the purpose of prayer, the purpose of worship, the purpose of taking a day of rest is to find the gospel, and in finding the gospel to find its power. Such a good word. And then those spontaneous moments tells me that we have to have a certain level of self-awareness. We have to kind of be living in our moments, being present with ourselves so that we catch these things, which is it's another difficult thing to do and sounds a little odd for the Christian, but is very, very important along the way that we cultivate those habits.
The reality, Ben, is that the Christian life is not passive. The Christian life is not let go and let God. That is just a wrong mantra. Although there's some truth to that, in that there's nothing that we bring to the table. But every indication from the writings of Paul or Peter, it's like, this is a fight and we engage. And so, yeah, there is self-awareness that needs to be part of our regular daily life. If Jesus really has transformed my life, then I want that to make a difference in my relationship with my wife, Sarah, or my interaction with my neighbor, or whatever it is. And so it is active. It's an active engagement mentally. I mean, we'll see this in Romans chapter 6, but the battle is between the ears. That's where it all begins. So I need to be mindful, I need to be thinking, and I need to know the gospel good enough for it to actually enter into these situations.
It's really important. I mean, something I've learned about myself is that I can't trust my own heart, right? Jesus says that about people. Mm. He says he didn't entrust himself to any man because he knew it was in the heart of every man. Yeah. I often kind of look and say, okay, I can't trust anybody else, but my heart is wayward. My heart is untrusting. I can't trust my own heart. Which is, I think, really important for us to maybe grab onto, especially as we continue to read down, 18, down yeah. through the end of verse 32, where Paul gets very, very specific and very, very graphic about what unrighteousness looks like and about what sin looks like. He talks about the wrath of God against those who practice unrighteousness. And this passage has been used by, I'm going to quote unquote, Christians as a weapon, when rather it should be, wouldn't you say, examining our hearts first yeah. before yeah. we use it as a means of judging the world?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good word. And we're going to see that also in chapter 2, where he really starts addressing the Jews, where it's like, you should look in the mirror. That really, that's the idea. As we get to verse 18, let me just take a quick step back and maybe just outline where Paul's going. So the first 17 verses are like that's the introduction. But then, now he's going to launch into, and it's all gospel. Everything's gospel from chapter the middle of chapter 1, verse 18, to the end. And so the first five chapters, what Paul's doing is he's laying out the gospel foundation that we are justified by faith alone. That's the whole first four chapters and the first part of chapter 5. And so it's a reminder. The Jews, the people he's writing to, they already know this, but he's reminding them. And so he begins, it's almost like he's laying out a court case for our guilt before God and then how God in his grace rescues us. So that's kind of where he goes. The next part, chapter 6 to 8, is the outplay of the gospel, how the gospel is going to sanctify us. And that's kind of the whole theme of this book, is the gospel bringing about the obedience of faith. And then chapters 9 to 11 is the defense of the gospel, where Paul just clearly lays out the sovereignty of God and that he's in absolute control. And then the last few chapters, chapter 12 to the end, becomes really practical. It's the impact of the gospel and relationships and the gospel. So it becomes super practical, but he's laying the foundation here now. And you're right, Ben. I think our attitude needs to be self-examination, but there is also a sense that that Paul, under the inspiration of God, is painting a clear picture of what we're seeing in our context even today. I mean, it's there, right? I don't know if you want to just walk through this text here, or if you have any thoughts that you want to add before we do that.
Well, I think, I don't have a whole lot of thoughts to add. I find myself really resisting this piece here because it is so countercultural, and it seems even to be a little bit different than the picture that we have of God, that I have of Jesus. That is kind of ingrained in me. Jesus loved me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. And then I read verse 8, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven.
Yeah.
How do I reconcile the love of God and the wrath of God?
Yeah. And the answer is in verse 17, the righteousness of God is revealed. That's how. And so the link between because God is perfectly, and he's perfectly loving, he's perfectly wrathful. How do those two things come together? And the answer is his righteousness. He's right in absolutely everything he does. And so he's absolutely perfect. And what Paul's trying to, the Puritans used to say, they used to say a few things, but they would always preach the law before grace, right? And kind of heap it on. Or they would say, you've got to get people lost before you can get them saved. And to some degree, that's kind of what Paul's doing here. He's just painting a picture of who we as human beings without God really are. That's all he's doing. He's saying we're guilty, we're without excuse, and because of that, we're under God's wrath. And I mean, we could circle right back to Genesis chapter 3, where Adam and Eve sin against God, and we're bearing the fruit of that today, right? And so that's really what he's doing in this section. He's just saying we're guilty, we don't have an excuse, and therefore we're under his wrath. And rightly so, God has every right to do that.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think sometimes we confuse. We look at the idea of wrath and even of anger as being something that is inherently evil. But that's us bringing in our preconceived notions to that.
Right.
That God, in his righteousness, has to demonstrate some sort of wrath. That at the same time, what the gospel tells us is that that wrath was diverted from us and put on to Christ. Therefore is something that should humble us as opposed to offend us. Paul holds nothing back, right? The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. And he goes on to kind of describe that. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah.
The suppression of the truth. And
well,
he kind of speaks to that throughout this whole rest of this chapter.
Well, and I think what you just finished saying, Ben, is exactly Paul's mindset. We should kind of squirm. The reality is we should squirm when we read these verses. The good news is we've read chapter 3, chapter 4, and chapter 5. So we know the answer. You've already said it. That wrath is diverted to Jesus. But until somebody recognizes that, this should make us squirm. And so what's important about this text here is that, and he shows that we're without excuse. In verse 19, Paul says, "For what can be known about God is plain to all of us, to the ungodly, to the unrighteous, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, divine nature, have been clearly perceived." How? Through the creation of the world. So there's this intelligence that God has given all of us. I walk out of my house, I look at Bastion Mountain or the stars tonight, if it's cloudless here and the moon's not shining, and I walk away recognizing, if I'm at all intuitive, that there is something bigger than me. That's just the reality. And so God says, there's an intelligence that's been given to every human being. And we are an intelligent race. We are intelligent people. But what's so scary is in verse 21, Paul says, "For although they knew God," how? "Through his creation, they did not honor him or give him thanks, but they became futile in their thinking and foolish, and their foolish hearts were dark. And claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." So there was this very clear ignoring of this revelation. So God reveals himself, even just through creation. Look at who I am. And there's this very deliberate, I'm going to ignore that. Or we could say they're ignorant. People who reject Jesus, that was me one day. That was my story. I rejected Jesus and I ignored him. I ignored all the evidences. I didn't want anything to do with it. And so that's, I think that's the play between God saying, here I am. And if you read the Bible, you know that he's a loving God, and people saying, I see that, but I'm going to just ignore it. I'm going to ignore any sort of revelation that you've given me. I don't want anything to do with you. That's a sinful heart.
These words, they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Paul is obviously speaking about the obvious idolatry of that day, where the people would worship statues, they would worship at shrines, they would worship these objects. You teach this, or have taught this, to Bible college students who are, you know, in the range of 19 to 25, give or take, and coming out of a Western culture. Is this still true? Is this, you know, we don't see the idolatry that he's describing here, but but is this still true for all of us that we have this propensity to do this? And then explain where you've seen this idolatry in our culture.
No, that's a really good question and really a segue to the next section. And so he's laid out this intelligence and the ignoring of it. And then Paul uses this interesting phrase three times in a row. Verse 24, therefore God gave them up. Verse 26, for this reason God gave them up. Verse 28, God gave them up. And that's a really important phrase because this is an action of God, and it's a way that he's going to, it's almost like he's saying, you want it your way? Then have at it. Go ahead. I'm going to give you up to your desire. You're ignoring me. You're worshiping something other than me. Then I'm going to let you go. I'm going to pull back all restraints. And in verse 24, is the answer to that question that you just asked about our college students, but not just our college students. All I got to do is look in the mirror and I recognize the reality of idolatry in my life. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts or desires, the word is desire, of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies, because they exchanged the truth of God about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. And anytime we worship anything besides the creator, we become idolaters. And that can be as broad as just, which we'll see here in a moment, promiscuous sexual encounters, which is on the one side, to the good stuff like ministry, Ben, where all of a sudden now I'm worshiping my ministry or my position or the things that in and of themselves are not wrong, but I've all of a sudden started worshiping those other than God. Idolatry is there. And I'm dishonoring God in that moment when I'm not worshiping him and I'm worshiping something lesser than him, a lesser satisfaction, which those things never deliver. They say, if you worship me, you're going to be happy. Not true. We know how it went for Adam and Eve. It went terribly when they worshiped the fruit rather than God, right? And it's the same way with us. Our only satisfaction is going to be when we worship God. But I mean, it's the net is pretty broad.
It's interesting, you know, how we discover those things is by introspection and even by living in community, inviting other people to kind of point the things out in our lives that capture our imagination, that we place our focus on. I think also, though, our grief and the things that we grieve kind of pulls at that. Like I said, we're in the middle of this pandemic, and we're all experiencing some sort of loss of a way of life or of a very carefully framed, crafted lifestyle. And I know for me, my work has changed dramatically.
Yeah.
And I'm grieving the loss of meaningful work, with which God has used to kind of show me that I may have been exchanging the glory of God for some lesser glory. Pastors all over the world are preaching to cameras and not to rooms. I know for me, that's a really hard thing, because there's a lot of glory in people responding to a message and smiling and in engaging and saying, good word, pastor, those kinds of things. It's so subtle, isn't it? Because Paul, and we've got to be careful we don't miss the subtlety of the idolatry, because we're so focused on you know, the abhorrent, the ugly, the very obvious descriptions that he gives in, say, verses 26 and 27. Our idolatry within the church exists, and it's subtle.
And that's not to take away from what Paul says in verses 26 to the end of the chapter, but the reality is we need to be willing to recognize the subtlety of sin and how easily, because it's pretty easy for me to look over the fence and look at somebody else and say, well, I'm not that. That's not who I am. Yet my heart is just as wayward as the person who might be doing these things. And I think that's the point. There is a progression, though. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Ben.
It's just a side thing. I'm sure those who are listening who have read this may notice it or not. But in verse 25, he throws at the very end there an amen.
How come
let it be so?
A good question. I don't know. You'll have to ask Paul one day why he did that, or the Spirit of God. But I mean, it is like it's an exclamation, like, this is really important. I mean, how crazy that you'd worship the creation over the creator. You're going to pursue the blessing over the blessor. You're going to worship the gift over the giver. I mean, it's ludicrous. We sit around the Christmas tree. We hand out presents. At the heart of that, though, I mean, maybe for kids, it's a little bit more of a struggle. But hopefully for us adults, the thing that brings us joy is the person who gave us the gift, not the gift itself. I mean, yeah, the gift brings some joy as well. There's nothing wrong with that. But how, I mean, how ludicrous that we would actually worship the gift over the giver, or long for a blessing over the blesser, or worship creation over the creator. I mean, that's, but Paul goes on and he carries on then with this thinking. And it's almost, it almost seems like Paul is painting a downward spiral, Ben, where it begins with this idolatry, where he, where he's talking about worshiping things other than God. And I think from a, like a Canadian context, I think we can see this. And then he goes on in verse 26. And though this is a very specifically speaking about homosexuality, I think the bigger title over verses 26 to 27, we might just want to put the word immorality there, not just homosexuality, but just general sexual immorality. And there's this sense that, that when we start worshiping the creation over the creator, we're going to start elevating that which has been created, namely man and women, and we're going to just let loose on that stuff, right? And sexual promiscuity is clear here. Gave them, he gave, God gave them over to dishonorable passions. And the women exchanging natural relations for those that are contrary to nature, and men likewise. And the penalty, it says in verse, the last part of verse 27, the penalty for their error, it's clear that that God's going to deal with this. But there is, even in our context, if you think about the acceptance of sexual immorality, like, you know, when I started pastoring back in the mid-80s, late 80s, even in a secular context, sleeping around in high school just would have not been very acceptable. You'd have been looked down on that back in the 80s. I mean, it's celebrated now. Sexual immorality is just celebrated. You turn on the TV and you just can't get away from the celebration of what we would see from a biblical standard, sexual immorality, or something that goes contrary to what God's design is. I mean, sex is a beautiful thing. It's created by God. He wants us to celebrate that, but he wants us to celebrate in the context of marriage. And so anything outside of that is a perversion that the enemy takes. And it's, I mean, it's rampant in our culture today in Canada. It's just rampant in Europe and down in the States.
You know, it's really interesting. You pointed out those three phrases, God gave them up, God gave them up, God gave them up. Verse 24, God gave them up to the lust of their hearts, right?
Yeah.
Giving them over to the worship center. He just said, I release you, worship however you want. In verse 26, he gave them up to their dishonorable passions. That is, he didn't put any restraint on their desires.
Yeah.
And in our culture, maybe you'd agree with me that a person's desires are as close to their identity as they can get. And so to betray your desires is to betray yourself, or so culture would say. Yep. And so giving yourself over to your desires is the most natural self-expression. But you're simply just enslaving yourself to some sort of desire that is just there. It's not liberating at all. It's enslaving. It's controlling. It's your compulsions. And I don't see any freedom in that.
No. And, you know, I mean, I look around our culture today, Ben, and I want to be so cautious and careful how I say this, because I say it with sincerity and with a concern for our Canadian culture. I say it for out of a love for those who don't see things my way or see things biblically. I should say that my way doesn't matter, but see things biblically. But what you've described is the last phrase in verse 28, God gave them over. And he says that God gives us over to a debased mind. And a debased mind, there's a number of different ideas that describe that word. But one of the meanings in the Greek is that a debased mind is a mind that can't think logically anymore. And that's a scary place to be, but you know, if you think about our whole cultural drift, as it were, we even here in Canada bind to the American dream, which is nothing short of idolatry. That's what it is. And then the sexual revolution comes along in the 60s. And if anything, it's just gained speed to the point where, you know, we turn on just, you know, daytime TV or early evening TV. And what we're watching today would have just been horrifying to somebody in the 70s and 80s. Like, what are you watching? I can't even believe you guys are watching this. To the point where God hands us over to a debased mind or a mind that can't even think logically anymore. And I mean, I don't need to paint the picture for any of our listeners or for you or me, Ben, to recognize that we find ourselves in a place today where logic is taken out of so many reasonings, even just what you just said. What should define us is our desires. Well, that's not even logical. Because taken to an extreme, there are people who have some really pretty bad desires, but we need to be careful where we go with that then, right? And so, I think about what used to dictate our context was science. Like, you know, in our modern age, we're now postmodern, which means science doesn't dictate us, right? It used to be biology will tell us whether you're a guy or a gal. Not anymore. And we've moved into this kind of this last spiral down where God says, okay, I'll hand you over. You want this? You really want this? I'm going to take all logic out of it. You just not even think logically anymore. And it's a sad testament of at least pockets of our context here in Canada today.
So maybe we can finish with this. So what's the hope then? Like, yeah. For those who are listening,
you gotta wait to chapter three. You gotta wait to chapter three.
I mean, we read this and we obviously come to it and we get a little bit defensive. And I think that's an important place to be if we're willing to, as Christians or as non-Christians, as seekers or as those who would call themselves saved, to humbly come and say, this needs to speak to my heart and direct me. The hope, I guess, would go back to verse 16, where we see that the greatest power, that the whole power of God for salvation is found in the gospel. So God releases people to the lust of their heart. He releases them to dishonorable passions. He releases them to a debased mind, but he doesn't leave them stranded, helpless, lost, and in the dark. Yeah. He's given us the gospel to rescue us from essentially ourselves.
Yeah, and I think for us as Christians, that is our message. But I think, once again, it's grace upon grace upon grace. I read a quote years ago that it was actually part of a prayer that reminds, and the phrase was, I'm cut from the same mold of cloth as the worst of sinner. God, would you remind me of that today, that I'm cut from the same mold of cloth as the worst of sinners? And that just brings a modesty to my heart to recognize that I'm capable without Jesus, without the gospel, without his spirit, I'm capable of anything. And so in our approach to our world and reaching out to our world, there needs to just be grace upon grace upon grace. I shouldn't expect anything else but rebellion from people who don't love Jesus, because that's their heart. Well, how are they going to turn to Jesus? If I beat them on their brow? I don't think so. What I need to do is present Jesus as more compelling than what they're doing right now. Show them that he's the bread of life, that he's the water that's going to quench their thirst. They're looking for satisfaction. And so grace upon grace upon grace is our response, not veering from the truth, being strong, holding firm, not compromising what we believe, but being gracious in doing that.
Yeah, and that's, and then we'll be able to tell these stories of people finding Christ in acknowledging lesser, that they'd lived according to lesser desires,
totally.
Lived as idolaters, lived in an illogical way. We don't claim any exceptionalism. Right? Yeah, yeah. The gospel doesn't allow us to do that. Yeah. We just say we've been saved by Christ, for Christ, through faith given by Christ, and we boast in him and him alone. That's Paul's language. I'm going to boast in Jesus and nothing in myself.
Yeah.
It starts by embracing that verses 24 down through 32 expose me.
Yeah,
and they expose me in a merciful way, that this is really not necessarily, it's the judgment of God, but the judgment of God and the mercy of God are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
And this whole thing is just showing me the mercy of God and a powerful reality. What we would hope for everybody who's listening believer or unbeliever alike. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Steve, for walking us through Romans 1. It's good stuff. This is going to be, man, it's going to be hard on my soul, but I'm digging it. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks again for this. Blessings to everybody who's listening out there. You can catch us again. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. God bless you. We love you. For those of you who are part of SCC, we miss you, and we're praying for you daily. Blessings, everyone.